Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. Disrespect welcomes Jeff Manishin, a criminal lawyer with Ross and McBride, who's had experience defending homicide defendants on legal aid. He's going to talk to us about the legal aid strike. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you, Jeff?
I'm good. I understand the need for the protest against legal aid. There's been a protest needed for a long time against legal aid on both sides, but you probably know more about it than I do. How long has it been since the rates went up meaningfully?
Meaningfully is a great question, Jeff, because I think in the last couple of years, they wound up being raised a couple of percentage points. I think that if you went back the last several, they may have had a total of something like 15%, but to put it in real numbers, the tariff, as I've recalled it, let's say back some years ago, was about, for a senior lawyer, over 10 years experience, was about $85 an hour. And now, several years later, they've increased, and I think it's up to $98 or $96 an hour.
Right. And the market rate for a senior lawyer?
Well, experienced lawyers will bill on an hourly rate, I'm sure anywhere from $300, $400, even $500 an hour.
Okay.
And as well, experienced criminal lawyers will also bill, or may also bill, a counsel fee rate, which may turn out to be higher than that. It might be $3,000 or $4,000 or even $5,000 a day. Top lawyers will go even higher than that.
What's a counsel rate?
Pardon me?
What's a counsel fee rate?
Well, for legal aid, there isn't one.
Right.
They used to have one several years ago. It was $500 a day for a day in court, and if you were over, I think it was over 10 years experience, you'd get a 25% experience upgrade.
So it's a premium,
it worked
premium
out to
for
be
litigation.
$625 as a counsel fee for a rate for a day in court, and a given day in court might go from 10 until 1, and then there's a lunch break, and oftentimes with the jury, they need that, and then 2:30 till, say, 4:30, something like that.
Okay.
But it's very intense work.
Yeah, for sure.
So now what happened was, several years ago, I think roughly early 90s, maybe mid-90s, they decided to change elements of the legal aid plan, which used to have block fees for certain offenses. So
well, you
to represent
like
somebody
rate.
On a break and enter. Sorry, go ahead.
Fixed rate.
It was well, and they're fixed rates on lots of things, but they used to have a block fee, kind of a flat rate, to do a guilty plea and everything that might have been involved on a break and enter or if we're going to do a trial. But for homicide, for murder cases, they didn't. I mean, it was hourly and it was counsel fee.
Right.
They changed everything and made it all hourly.
Oh, really?
And yeah, and so they took away the counsel fee rate.
Oh.
And what it became was, back then, it'd be, say, $85 an hour. If we do the math, and your same day in court that got you $625, effectively was reduced to, call it, $425.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it wasn't because you weren't working as hard or the work was less complex.
Yeah.
It was because with a view of restructuring what they pay on the legal aid plan, it was determined that's how they were going to do it. And so it's from there that they've done the adjustments. They've never gone back to the counsel fee rate.
Really?
Well, and then the other thing they used to do, too, Jeff, was they had a feature called it was Note A on your legal aid certificate. If you happen to get an exceptional result for a client, say you win a four-week murder trial or you get serious charges withdrawn because of a presentation you could make to the Crown or to the court, you could apply for a discretionary increase.
Oh.
There wouldn't be any sort of set number, but it might be a couple hundred dollars or something.
Okay.
That's gone.
Okay.
And then the other thing they changed, too, is it used to be if you did a case out of town, and I've done cases in other jurisdictions, if you were, say, driving down to Welland, fine, you could bill for that hour of travel time, and if you wanted, you know, you could also bill for mileage.
And that's at a travel rate, though.
Yeah, I think that you could bill There may have been a slightly reduced rate, but you could still bill for your travel time.
Right.
And also, you know, look for compensation for mileage.
Right.
Gone and gone.
Okay.
You can't do that anymore. They don't pay anything for travel.
Okay. So there's a disincentive to travel, and there's a disincentive to go to court.
Well, I don't know if I'd say disincentive to go to court. The way I'd phrase it in terms of disincentive to travel, I think the philosophy was, look, there are probably going to be qualified lawyers in the local jurisdiction. Why do they need to be able to fund somebody from out of town? And the concept has traditionally been the ordinary client of modest means.
Right.
It's kind of the test to say, is that what the legal aid plan would fund? And I guess their reasoning process was, the government's was, well, maybe the ordinary client of modest means couldn't afford to hire a lawyer from out of town.
Oh, I see.
That may be the rationale behind it. But the difficulty is, in some jurisdictions, there just aren't that many qualified lawyers to do the case.
Sure, find a criminal lawyer in Jarvis, yeah.
Well, you know, you might be into the Norfolk area, and there are certainly some, but what if they don't want to take the case? What if they're busy? What if there's a particular challenge to the case that a lawyer from Toronto or even from Hamilton might have expertise in?
Oh, yeah.
Well, you're going to wind up going to that lawyer, and that lawyer is going to be looking at a legal aid plan now, which would expect him or her to take the case and do the drive down, for example, to Simcoe for free.
Yeah, let me clarify this for our listener. There's a premium of experience or talent or ability involved in actual in-court litigation. Not every lawyer wants to do it. Not every lawyer can do it well. And there was a premium to be paid when you did it, and now there's not, right?
Well, I think the way we'd phrase it, apart from the idea of premium, because the legal aid plan was always structured, you know, based on years of experience, up to 5 years at a certain rate, 5 to 10 at another rate, over
yeah.
10 another rate.
Yeah.
The way I choose to, I think, focus it is this way, Jeff. Not every lawyer is qualified to be able to represent somebody in a murder case.
Yeah.
So now your pool is going to be reduced.
Yeah.
Of the ones that are qualified, there may not be that many that are prepared to take a case on legal aid, and they don't have to.
No.
But you'd say, gee, of the ones that are qualified, that are willing to do the case for that rate,
mm-hmm.
do you want to basically structure it where you're also going to ask them to drive back and forth an hour each way for free?
Yeah.
That's a lot to ask.
Yeah.
And so what's difficult is, and I appreciate what criminal lawyers do, it's a difficult time economically for everybody. But on the other hand, the plan hasn't changed for a long time. And the Criminal Lawyers Association felt, look, how do we get the message out to the government to say you just can't ignore us any longer? There have been government studies recommending increases to the legal aid tariff. One of the government studies involved long, complex trials, and the former Chief Justice of Ontario and a professor from the University of Toronto, an experienced criminal lawyer himself and a former, he was deputy AG, recommended the problem with longer trials is sometimes you have counsel that aren't that experienced that are doing them.
Okay.
And so why not ensure that experienced counsel will do them and things can move along?
Yeah.
And they recommended an increase to the legal aid tariff.
Who is the deputy AG?
Oh, it's Professor Michael Coate. He and former Chief Justice Pat Lesage were commissioned to report to the government of Ontario on issues and problems that arise from long trials.
Okay.
And they did a report, I think it was in 2008.
And it was called the?
Well, it's referred to as the Coate-Lesage Report.
Okay.
I forget the formal title, but it had to do with the commission inquiring into or looking into difficulties in long and complex criminal cases.
Yeah.
And that was their recommendation, and so there have been a few. So one might say that the evidence is there to support the change in the tariff. Now, the government might say, well, where can we find the money? We just don't have it.
Yeah.
So you wind up in a situation where if you went back a year or two ago, maybe times were more flush. The tariff wasn't changed then significantly. What are you going to do? What are criminal lawyers going to do at a certain stage? You say, look, how do we get the government's attention to say it is really a time for a change?
Yeah.
And not huge, but, I mean, let's get a mechanism to increase it.
Yeah.
And it could phase it in a few years, but
people on fixed incomes are facing much simplified difficulties in the same vein. You know, in good times, fixed incomes were reduced. They were not increased. And now that it's hard times, they're saying, look, you know, food went up by 17% last year. Our incomes went up by 2%. What are you going to do?
Sure, and you could even say this, in tougher economic times, more people need to rely upon legal aid.
Oh, absolutely.
So that's another feature. So what happened was, to give the listeners a little bit of a history, It was the Ontario Criminal Lawyers Association felt as a way of getting the government's attention to the problem, they would start. It's not really, I suppose, I don't know what's right to call it a strike, but let's characterize it as a boycott for the acceptance of new legal aid certificates for murder or for attempt murder or for appeals on murder cases.
What's the philosophy?
Murder or the complex guns and gangs cases that there are the whole squads and teams doing investigation and prosecution on the trial.
Tell us what the philosophy is behind selecting these cases, because, I mean, there's a lot of legal aid certificate cases that aren't capital crimes.
Yeah, great question. And I think the answer to that one, Jeff, is criminal lawyers didn't want to say to the public of Ontario, look, we aren't going to do these cases. We aren't going to take legal aid certificates. We're just going to cut you off cold.
Right.
The idea was, how can you get the message across? How can you make a statement? How can you get the government's attention in a way that will characterize it as meaningful but moderate? So lawyers are still taking legal aid cases in a host of other issues.
Like family law and stuff, yeah.
Well, whether family law or sexual assault cases.
Oh, okay.
Impaired causing death or bodily harm,
okay.
Fraud, robbery, break and enter.
Really?
All kinds. They're still taking the certificates for those cases.
I see.
But the idea was, let's make it focused.
Yeah.
Let's make it meaningful.
Yeah.
And they started in Toronto. And lawyers didn't have to, shall we say, sign on, but they did in substantial numbers.
Yeah.
And then when that didn't lead to any significant change, it has gradually spread to other jurisdictions. And so other cities, their local criminal law associations or local law association criminal law sections have been asked, will you participate? And lawyers have.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I gather it goes from Thunder Bay to Ottawa now.
I think that's right. And you know, we'll keep our eye open on if cities are not yet in. I expect they will be. I mean, Hamilton's one. I think Barrie is another. It's, you know, it has expanded, and I think you'd find a lot of criminal lawyers that are very supportive of it. We're deeply concerned about it, and it's the idea is, can you come up with a solution that's not simply short term? Well, we'll just do this a temporary change.
Mm-hmm.
Come up with a structure. A mechanism for reviewer. We say every year, every couple of years, it will be reviewed. You won't have to get to this problem.
Yeah.
That's the objective. And
the Rodney, the Rodney Dangerfield objective. I want some respect.
Pardon me?
The Rodney Dangerfield objective. I want some respect.
Well, you could characterize it. Yeah, you could characterize it that way. I think that the work is sufficiently difficult, and the skill set is, you know, that's involved, that's required, is pretty substantial. So what do you do to have appreciating that you want to provide a legal aid plan that's meaningful and that's important and that ensures people do get good representation and that there are qualified lawyers that are willing to take it on? Because that's been a problem over the years. Criminal lawyers have been basically ceasing doing legal aid cases.
Yeah.
And so now you say, well, okay, who's it going to be left to? The ones that are willing to continue to hang in there, go through the difficult work, or the ones who aren't as experienced, maybe not qualified.
Yeah.
So that's really what, it wasn't an approach that the Criminal Law Association did with a great, I'll characterize it as, with any level of happiness or enthusiasm. There was a measure of reluctance, a measure of, okay, we'll do this. It's not something we rush to have to do. We're used to representing people, but we've got to get this message out.
And now for a short break, pianist Steve Baer and Memories of Albert Ammons. We've been talking with criminal lawyer with Ross and McBride, Jeff Manishin, about the legal aid strike that's been gathering strength for some weeks in Ontario communities against the low rates that have been paid to legal professionals and their effect before and after the strike on clients.
Somebody asked me recently who's not familiar with legal aid, was fortunate enough to have a lawyer work for them on consignment on occasion, and said, why would the lawyers do that? And
when you say on consignment, you mean on contingency?
Contingency, yeah.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I don't know why they would do that. I'm going to find out in the interview, but I can think of a number of reasons. One is that these are dramatic charges that are going to capture the public's imagination. If you're not defending someone who's facing perhaps life imprisonment or organized crime-related sentence, people know these are tough sentences, and they know that people who are convicted unjustly will pay very stiff penalties for something that they didn't have to do. The other thing is, these may be more complex cases because of the stakes, and maybe the lawyers are thinking that once the courts are tied up with these complex cases and people who don't know how to handle them, maybe the government will sit back and do the math. And worst case scenario, maybe it'll occur to somebody in the government that not only are they going to spend a lot of time prosecuting these cases, they're going to spend a lot of time on doing them once they've been wrongly done, too. There's going to be a lot of appeals. There's going to be a lot of go-backs. There's going to be a lot of restitution.
Compensation, you mean, for people wrongly convicted?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know how much of that was right, but you tell me.
Well, you know, it's not an outcome that anybody from the Criminal Lawyers Association would want to see occur.
No.
And so let's go back and say, why would a criminal lawyer take on a murder case?
All right.
And I think there's a few different reasons. I think that there are those who are, and many are, deeply committed to the cause of justice.
Okay.
And they want to ensure that someone gets proper representation on the principle that in our society, democratic society, people are entitled to that.
Yes.
There are people who find it fulfilling. Mm-hmm. They say, this is what I'm capable of doing, and this is what I love to do and live to do, and this is a great challenge for me. And it's so there's a level of satisfaction to it.
So the high stakes are a driver for them.
Well, we could say the high stakes, there's an element for some lawyers of that, the challenges that come up in those sorts of cases. For some, it may well be the variety to say, okay, I haven't had a case which involves, for example, psychiatric issues.
Okay.
You know, with a not criminally responsible mental disorder. And I really believe in ensuring that an individual who is suffering from that difficulty gets the best representation in the position, the position gets put forward fully.
Okay.
There's a whole variety of reasons. I mean, obviously, you could, too, the obvious one is some people would say, well, to make money.
Sure.
You know, you aren't going to get rich, I don't believe, on a legal aid homicide practice. Okay? Or alternatively, if you were, what kind of hours are you going to have to work? They could be extremely long.
Yeah.
To, you know, at that rate.
And
there's a risk, too, in the legal aid plan currently. You know, it does happen that you submit your account and they say, well, sorry, we aren't going to pay you for all of that.
Yeah, they have caps, don't they?
Okay, we may cap it, that's right. You've gone over the cap. Well, fine, then all you're getting is the hours you said you were going to do with the case in, or the hours we said you could do it, you'd have to be limited to.
Yeah.
So, you know, you wind up in a situation where you put in these extra hours because of your commitment, your dedication, your professionalism, and you don't get paid at the end.
So the caps
So how do you manage your office?
The caps
how do you cover your overhead?
Issue,
pay staff, look after bookkeeping,
yeah.
Renting, photocopying space, all those things.
So that's issue number two in this book.
Well, it's a reality for lawyers in private practice. And remember that from the government side, they can have a couple on a guns and gangs case. They may have a team of prosecutors assigned to those.
Mm-hmm.
But it may be one defense lawyer.
Yeah.
So then you say, gee, what are potential outcomes? Well, the commission into pediatric forensic pathology chaired by Commissioner Gouge, the Justice of the Court of Appeal, expressed some concerns over the complexities of pediatric homicide cases, shaken baby syndrome and matters of that sort, and the need for proper compensation by the legal aid plan for experts that may be rehired by the defense. They actually get paid at a lower rate than the government pays experts retained by the Crown.
Yeah.
So Commissioner Gouge, in his report, and there were a number of issues of wrongful conviction there, expressed some concern over inequities in the legal aid plan, and he recommended changes.
Yeah,
so
it's
not that anybody wants to see the government put to the expense of compensation or people wrongly convicted or inadequately represented. Nobody on the defense wants to see that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the reality. If lawyers won't take the cases on, or if they're inadequately resourced, there is a risk of it. And that's
yeah. So with or without the boycott, these penalties are appearing.
Well, we've had, I think, lawyers that have declined taking legal aid cases.
Yeah.
Legal aid homicide cases, and it's left for others to do. And it used to be 2 years back, you could even, a senior lawyer could have a junior counsel work with him or her, and at a reduced rate,
mm-hmm.
and they've cut back on that a fair amount.
Really?
Now, the old system of younger lawyers learning, working with senior lawyers, thus being able to take on a homicide case themselves, that's really diminished.
Why?
I guess it's a matter of funding.
Yeah.
But they say, no, sorry, we aren't going to authorize a junior.
Okay. Yeah.
So, the whole situation, I think we could probably say, Jeff, from every standpoint, currently,
mm-hmm.
is not satisfying. It's not satisfactory. It's not desirable. And it's a real problem for all concerned, and I include the government in that. And so the hope is that they basically take steps to say, look, where can we want to find the resources and phase it in over a period of time if necessary.
Yeah.
But offer some encouragement to say we are committed to doing something, and we are doing something.
Yeah.
Not, well, it's the wrong time. Not, well, it's we're having not problems, we haven't got the funds.
We're studying it.
Yeah, or we need more reports, or we need more evidence.
Yeah.
Or I think the other problem, I think, too, is it may well be, and I may be wrong on this, but the public sentiment so often these days is in favor of law and order.
Out of sight,
why
out of mind,
we,
yeah.
Pardon me?
Out of sight, out of mind.
Well, it's a matter of saying, gee, these guys should be punished. Gee, these guys, these terrible crimes, these guys
yeah,
should
be, these guys,
should be
yeah.
punished.
Yeah, which includes everyone who's accused as guilty by presumption.
Well, that can happen. And so...
That's inherent in that attitude, though.
Well, on the law and order emphasis, to see yeah. that people are, you know, are punished, they're charged, they're prosecuted, and they're punished, and you're going to wait a sec. How about the fair trial element?
Yeah.
A presumption of innocence element.
Yeah.
The proper representation by independent counsel element.
Yeah.
I think that for those who say, gee, we've got to emphasize law and order, you'd like to be able to say to them, sure, but don't you want to ensure that the justice system works fairly and soundly and in a principled way that respects the rights of those people that are charged? They don't have the kind of resources the state does. So that's the kind of message that I try and explain to people when I get the opportunity to do so, is to just say, look, there is another perspective. Just keep it in mind.
Yeah, good. Yeah. No, that's a very, that's an attitude that might catch too. You don't have to invalidate your point of view that you want law and order, but there is another perspective, and maybe you could think of it too.
Sure. Well, as you raised earlier, I mean, nobody wants to see a wrongful conviction. Not only is there a fundamentally wrong aspect to a person being found guilty in jail for a crime he or she didn't commit,
mm-hmm.
but you get into the issue of what about the right the real perpetrator having escaped sanction.
Yeah.
And what about the cost of incarcerating somebody wrongly for many years?
Yeah.
And what about the cost of the appellate process and potential compensation at a future stage? You know, on many levels, it's really undesirable. What about the feeling of, gee, our justice system failed? How about that one?
Yeah.
How about, gee, it didn't work the way it should have?
Yeah.
Nobody wants to be, I believe Canadians are principled and committed to a true democratic and just criminal justice system. And part of that involves the avoidance of wrongful conviction.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think the problem is not enough people see themselves in that box in court.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, and you see it in a variety of different ways. People don't, they may not really have the sense of what it is like to be charged with a criminal offense.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be very stressful.
Mm-hmm.
And you have resources marshaled against you, and who do you look to for support? And sometimes it's the only, aside from family, the only bastion you have to stand between the power of the state and your own loss of liberty is your lawyer.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's a heavy responsibility, and I believe criminal lawyers try and live up to that in a responsible way.
I spoke to Frank Addario, the Criminal Lawyers Association, to get the referral to you, and I asked him. I tried to get a heads up on this interview, and I said, "So have you made any progress?" He says, "Oh yeah. I got a check in the mail for $120 million today." He says, "Jeff Manishin will bring you up to date."
Frank is known for his droll or dry sense of humor.
Yeah. Well, I gather that whatever progress you may have made is very, very subtle at this point, for lack of a better word.
I don't know that there's any real progress. We're in the summer. I don't know that the legislature is really turning their attention to it. They're certainly aware of it.
Okay.
And, you know, in terms of the stage at which we might actually see something, I mean, I'm sure it would be great to be able to see a response in the summer. But even if it was a matter of the Attorney General being able to say, look, here's the plan we're working on right now. Here's what I can come back to you with. We intend to achieve this by this level, by this date. I've got support of cabinet colleagues, for example, at this stage.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the kind of changes we're working towards making that might create some level of encouragement. But at this stage, I don't know that I could identify anything in the way of progress. But then I'm not part of the Criminal Lawyers Association executive, so Frank would be in a better position to tell you than me.
If he thinks you could bring me up to date, what you know is probably pretty much what he knows.
Yeah, I think when Frank talked about the check in the mail, as I say, Frank and I go back a long ways. And, sometimes I have to watch myself. What? Did you really mean that, Frank? Okay. Because sometimes he'll say something in a deadpan way that's funny.
But I
would tell you this.
He picked a figure out of thin air, obviously.
Yeah, sure. I would tell you this on this issue. Frank and the Criminal Lawyers Association executive, I think, are generally felt amongst our membership as showing really strong leadership.
Good.
Remember, Frank has his own practice to manage.
Okay.
It's not like we have him on salary to be our president for the year.
But he doesn't just
do
that.
He has a practice to run in addition to being the president, and that means being available for all kinds of media interviews. And it isn't only on the legal aid issue.
Okay.
You may have seen the other day when there were issues, there were decisions by the Supreme Court of Canada on interpretations of the Charter of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
Frank was quoted in relation to that.
Yeah.
When the government proposes tougher law and order based statutory minimum sentences for more crimes sentencing options, Frank may well be interviewed on that. So I think what he likes to be able to do is when you have people in local communities who can articulate the positions on behalf of the association, I'm sure he's happy to delegate it.
I've
talked about this issue before, and
if there's a
listener who hasn't yet heard how the analysis of the issues goes, then that's what I'd like to be able to share.
Well, I think you have. Is there anything else that you would like to say that we haven't touched on?
No, I appreciate Jeff having the opportunity to explain the issues this way. You try and do it in a fair and balanced way, and you try and ensure that people understand it's not simply a matter of, lawyers want more money. Something else. No, but there are people that will react that way.
I know.
Without considering the entire picture.
Yeah.
Whenever I've had the opportunity to do any media commentary, whether it's TV or radio, it regularly happens. People come up to me later saying, I understand the issues better. Thanks for explaining them.
Yeah.
I didn't understand it the way that you... Before you explained it, I didn't understand it that way. I didn't have the full picture. And now I do, and thanks for doing that. I don't mind. I think that's the kind of responsibility lawyers have.
Okay.
And on issues of law, but also on issues of, you could call it, social policy. And in this particular case, on issues of justice, access to justice, and why we're taking a particular position that might, on the face of it, seem to be unreasonable. The opportunity to be able to say, here's why we're doing it, I hope you can understand it and appreciate it and potentially support it and maybe even talk to your members of the provincial legislature and say, look, you guys should do something about it. I understand the issue. I'm not going to be silent. I do feel strongly enough that I can make the phone call, send an email.
Yeah.
That's as much as I can ask.
Well, you have not to be hard-edged about it, but you have a 2-year run-up to the next provincial election, and I think that's in your favor, too.
Well, we'll see. I mean, you know, I've said in the past sometimes, Jeff, the problems with politics is it's too political. You know, you'd like to feel that...
I'll make that a slogan for the show.
Oh, yeah. You'd like to feel that politicians aren't driven just by what does it take to get reelected. They're really committed to what's best for my community, locally, regionally, and provincially.
Yeah.
What's best for with the weighty responsibilities I have in office, a balancing a variety of interests.
Yeah.
And if it turns out I don't get reelected, well, I did the job the way I believe I should do the job.
Yeah.
That's really what you'd like to see from politicians, and I'll continue to hope that that'll be the approach that'll be followed here, and that they will realize how difficult the situation we face at the present time with the legal aid plan, and they have the studies that really give all the rationale behind the change. So it just becomes now a matter of saying, okay, we've got to do something.
Well, they're deep into their second term, so their pensions are secure, and maybe they can turn their attention to the priorities.
I don't know if provincial politicians get pensions.
No,
that's an area outside of my expertise.
Okay. Well, I just hope that that they've been at this long enough now to understand the importance of what you've told us today. Thanks very much.
My pleasure, Jeff.
All right. Thanks, Jeff.
Okay,
bye.
You've been listening to Jeff Manishin, a criminal lawyer with Ross and McBride in Hamilton. Tell us about the legal aid strike, the low rates that have been paid to legal professionals, and their effect before and after the strike on clients. Leading up to our roundup of the news, Kenny Blues boss Wayne, coat and hat.
Been drinking all night, having a good old time. I've been drinking all night, having a good old time. I had this awful feeling my mind worked overtime. I think I left my hat at the Purple Cafe. I must have dropped my coat in my neighbor's driveway. Believe me, I lost my coat and hat. Let me explain, don't swing that baseball bat. My neighbor's driveway, believe me, I lost my coat and hat. Let me explain, don't swing that baseball bat. Someone stole my coat, I can't explain. Believe me, someone stole my coat and hat. I'm going insane, don't take away your welcome mat. I don't know where I left my coat and hat. I don't know where I left my coat and hat. When I got home, I was reading about baseball.
Opening this week's roundup of the news. Thursday, July 23rd, Spectator. Joe Brandt softens home first offensive. Joseph Brandt Hospital is apologizing to patients and their families for how a controversial initiative to get seniors out of hospital quicker was implemented. It is reviewing how to communicate and execute it in a compassionate and caring way. The review is in response to growing concern from families who felt pressured to take loved ones home to free up hospital beds. Marilyn Fluke, who said Joseph Brandt made her feel irresponsible and unloving for refusing to take her bedridden 88-year-old mother home, wants the philosophy itself changed. It sounds like they're not going to change their position, she said. It doesn't sound like much of a concession. And from the editorial letters to the Spectator following the publication of that article, shameful of Lynn to adopt Home First policy. What a shameful policy for the local health integration network to adopt. But let's face it, this is just a demographic blip. There are lots of seniors now, but after the baby boomers, who are really going to put a strain on the system, are dead, it'll all be okay. There'll be no need to provide all the help they need through the Community Care Access Center or go wild building long-term care facilities. Simply cut back on health care. The longer they wait, the less likely they are to survive, right? Take meds off the approved and paid for list so they can't afford them. Allow them to go without doctors because they need too much attention and new doctors will not take them on as patients. Shove them out of the hospitals to go home to die. Think of the pension dollars to be saved. One $2,500 payment for a funeral and voila, savings all around. And that from Catherine Werner in Hamilton. And again from The Spectator, letters at thespec.com, ageism behind home first strategy regarding age plane for healthcare failures, letters July 15th. The letter writer clearly articulates the ageism behind this extremely offensive strategy of home first that some Ontario hospitals are promoting. This is hardly the answer to a complex problem. This public relations approach to fixing the system is so ill-conceived, I can't even begin to list the ethical issues involved. System integration requires that organizations share power and resources as well as work together in a collaborative fashion. If we want to create a system where people can receive care in the right place, at the right time, and by the right service providers, a major shift needs to happen in terms of how organizations are funded and how they collaborate. Shame on the hospitals for making older people feel they are a burden on our society. That from the letter from Anju Joshi, Associate Professor, Department of Health, Aging and Society, McMaster University. Globe and Mail, July 25th, 2009. Don't cut rehabilitation benefits for car crash victims. Dino Ladon and his family were driving along Highway 401 to his parents in Chatham, Ontario, back in August 1998 when a speeding Corvette sideswiped this sports utility vehicle, sending it rolling into a ditch. The horrific accident killed his 79-year-old grandmother. Mr. Ladon, 28 at the time, emerged from the wreckage with injuries that were immediately apparent. Major brain injury, partial paralysis in one hand, and a broken arm and ribs. But it was not until nearly a year after the accident that his wife, Alfreda Ladon, was also diagnosed with a major brain injury. In the aftermath of the accident, everyone was focused on the 29-year-old woman's severe physical injuries. Ms. Ladon was 8 months pregnant and lost her baby. She also sustained lung damage and two broken legs that required use of a wheelchair for several months. It took a series of neurological tests to uncover that Ms. Ladon was suffering from more than post-traumatic stress disorder, Mr. Ladon said in an interview. She couldn't concentrate like she used to. She'd scramble things. Brain injury advocates say Ms. Ladon's case serves as a cautionary tale for the Ontario government, the province's insurance regulators calling on the government to reduce benefits from medical care for victims of automobile accidents. The Financial Services Commission of Ontario has made 39 recommendations in its 5-year review on auto insurance, by far the most contentious. Is the proposal to cut medical rehabilitation benefits for most injuries to $25,000 from $100,000. Finance Minister Dwight Duncan is expected to respond to the review before the fall. It will be up to him to balance the competing interests between the insurance industry and the 12,000 people seriously injured in auto accidents every year in Ontario, as well as providers of medical and rehabilitation services. The medical director of the brain injury clinic at St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto said reducing the cap to $25,000 would not cover the multiple therapies needed to produce the best results for victims. Mr. Ladon said his injuries were considered catastrophic, making him immediately eligible for $1 million worth of treatment, but it took more than a year to classify his wife's injuries as catastrophic. He said if her treatment had been capped at $25,000, she would never have received the proper diagnosis and treatment, he said. Today, the couple have recovered enough to return to their jobs. He is a financial manager of a Toronto marketing company, and she is a part-time teacher. They also now have 3 daughters, ages 9, 6, and 4. We're back to a normal life, Mr. Ladon said. And from the Canadian Press via The Spectator, despite a decline in rates for heart disease and stroke among Canada's population overall, cardiovascular disease is actually on the rise in two segments of society, people under age 50 and those of lower socioeconomic status, researchers have found. Our results indicate that young people are increasingly bearing the burden of cardiovascular risk factors, said Dr. Douglas Lee, a scientist at the Institute for Clinical Evaluative Sciences. This is an important group because they are the ones who will predict future heart disease. And earlier onset of cardiovascular disease means potentially longer and more intense treatment over their lifetime, said Lee, who led a 1994 to 2005 study of national trends in heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, obesity, and smoking prevalence. The study, published recently in the Canadian Medical Association Journal, looked at a sample of Canadians aged 12 and up and from all socioeconomic and ethnic groups. It found the prevalence of heart disease and diabetes is rising fastest among Canadians of lower socioeconomic status. Younger Canadians who may not consider themselves candidates for early heart disease should get routine medical exams to identify risk factors, the authors advise. This report is covered in greater detail in a larger paper, The Globe and Mail, on Tuesday, July 1st, 2009. The reporter there is Carly Weeks. And in the National Post, Friday, July the 17th, ethicist seeks law to say when dead is truly dead, cites growing use of organs from cardiac victims. My, that's an interesting dovetail with the last article, isn't it? By Tom Blackwell, a new trend to harvest transplant organs from people whose hearts have just stopped but may not yet be brain dead has underlined the pressing need for federal legislation to define exactly when someone has perished, a leading medical ethicist argues. Healthcare workers motivated simply by the desire to help seriously ill patients are at risk of civil or even criminal court action because of the lack of a clear definition of death, said Jocelyn Downey of Dalhousie University in the Canadian Journal of Anesthesia. The cardiac death protocol, meanwhile, should probably be halted until more is known about when someone whose heart has stopped is beyond recovery, Professor Downey said. We need clarity around this because it is critically important for a host of reasons, she said in an interview. It's only after the declaration of death that certain things can happen. We can take your organs, we can bury you, we can do an autopsy, we can trigger all sorts of things around your property. The law in Canada is muddy, her paper indicates. Most provinces' legislation suggests that death is to be determined by physicians according to, quote, current medical practice, unquote. PEI's law is a little more specific, saying death can include brain death, while Quebec has no legal definition at all, leaving the matter completely to doctors. But the head of Ontario's Trillium Gift of Life Network, the country's largest transplant organization, said his agency endorsed the new donation after cardiac death, the DCD protocol, only after extensive research and consultation that ensured it is a moral and medically appropriate practice. About 60 such procedures have been performed in the past 4 years in a dozen or so Ontario hospitals, as well as a handful of times in Quebec, BC, and Nova Scotia, said Frank Markle, Trillium's CEO. Consent to procure organs and halt further treatment is always first obtained from patient families, he said. Only about 1-2% of patients are declared brain dead first, however. Evidence suggests that patients whose heart has stopped for 5 minutes may not be irreversibly brain dead, Professor Downey notes. Therefore, the possibility exists that some NHBD donors may not be legally dead under prevailing Canadian laws, her article argues. Joseph Verheed, one of the authors of a Mayo Clinic paper, said in an interview that there is a reluctance by doctors to be upfront about the meaning of terms like brain death and reveal to loved ones that grandpa may not be as dead as they thought. Transparency is needed to ensure the public's trust in the process, he argued. If informed consent is given to organ donation, however, and family has agreed to not resuscitate their loved one after the heart has stopped, there should be no barrier to then recovering organs immediately, Professor Verheed said. Professor Downey endorses a similar concept for a new federal law, recommending that death be defined as the irreversible end of functioning of the organism of the whole. Irreversible could include a situation where consent was given to not trying to resuscitate the patient and to harvesting organs, she said. Doctors aim to revise law on euthanasia. Also, Friday, July 17th, Post. Canada's continuing debate on the right to die, prodded by court cases and proposed legislation, seems to be heading for a new round this fall, according to a report the Quebec College of Physicians may recommend Canada's criminal code be revised to permit a form of medical euthanasia in strictly controlled circumstances. Alex Schadenberg, the executive director of the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition Canada, says he is opposed to anything that results in the direct and intended killing of other people, but argues that if death is induced by high doses of pain medication, this is not euthanasia, he says. Intent is the key. When a physician is using a huge amount of analgesic to make patients comfortable and not intending their death, there is no euthanasia taking place. It's actually a subtle thing in common law, he argues. Michelle Bouva of the Catholic Organization for Life and Family agrees intent is key. Giving physicians the right to directly intentionally cause death would go against public safety, she said. I can see this happening very easily, a loss of trust between doctors and patients. The bill, sponsored by Ms. Lalonde, who is battling cancer, is due for debate this fall after receiving first reading in the House of Commons. From the Globe and Mail, Wednesday, July the 8th, Howard Hyde inquiry. Widow says police delayed relaying her warning about man's mental state. The widow of Howard Hyde, a paranoid schizophrenic who died in custody, said that she told police the night her husband was arrested that he was off his medication and had been acting erratically and violently. But Halifax Regional Police Constable Giles Gillis, who took this information from Karen Ellett, testified in an inquiry into the 2007 death that he did not immediately pass it on to the officers who had Mr. Hyde in custody. Mr. Hyde was tasered twice and lost consciousness, died 30 hours after he was arrested, collapsing during a struggle with guards in one of the jail's holding cells. Karen Ellett said that when her husband was taking his medication, he was an active and sociable person, but he did not like taking the drugs and when off them could be abusive and irrational. Through it all, she stuck with him, believing she could help him manage his psychotic episodes. I loved him, she explained sadly. Globe and Mail, Tuesday, July 14th. Officer denies he doctored his report in tasering death. By Oliver Moore in Halifax. A police officer involved in the tasering of paranoid schizophrenic Howard Hyde could not explain why so much of his report was essentially identical to one written earlier by a colleague, but denied the suggestion he had doctored it. Constable Edwards repeatedly denied having cribbed his colleague's report. The inquiry also walked through the lead-up to the tasering, with Constable Edward offering new details on the alleged risk posed by Mr. Hyde. He testified that the booking room struggle brought the prisoner within reach of a drawer full of knives and other weapons. The drawer was unlocked, and the one immediately above it was missing, he said, allowing a clear view of these weapons. The prisoner received his first tasering seconds later. Constable Edwards acknowledged that his notes or other paperwork do not include mention or concern over Mr. Hyde arming himself during the struggle. The officer explained the late revelation by saying he had a lot on his mind in the aftermath of the incident. Whoops. July the 15th, the Globe and Mail. The next day, key witness admits to copying colleague's report. Constable also acknowledges that he erred when he told investigators that paranoid schizophrenic was warned before being tasered. By Oliver Moore, Halifax. A day after saying definitively that he had, quote, never read, unquote, a colleague's report, a key police witness at the inquiry into the jailhouse death of a mentally ill man acknowledged lifting material from that report for his own paperwork on the incident. Halifax Regional Police Constable Jonathan Edwards, the officer who arrested Howard Hyde, also testified that he erred when he told RCMP investigators that the paranoid schizophrenic man was warned before being tasered. Friday, July 17th, Globe. Halifax officer denies uttering profane threat before Hyde was tasered. The police officer who tasered Howard Hyde denied uttering a profane threat that the prisoner would be, quote, doing the dance next, unquote, testifying that the comment must have come from the mentally ill man himself. The only three people in the room were two officers and Mr. Hyde, who was being booked in late November of 2007 when the microphone on a nearby surveillance camera recorded the contentious words. Mr. Hyde's version can never be known. He was tasered twice during the fracas that broke out immediately after the comment and died in a Dartmouth jail 30 hours later. One of the officers present in the fingerprint room at Halifax Police Quarters during the incident testified Monday at an inquiry into the death that he had not made the threat, and yesterday the second officer, Special Constable Gregory McCormick, said it was not him either. Outside the courtroom, Mr. Hyde's sister denied it was Mr. Hyde's voice. Special Constable McCormick had testified yesterday that Mr. Hyde looked scared in the fingerprint room and tried to back away as police went to cut the knotted drawstring on his shorts. We reassured him we were only cutting out the lace, he recounted. The officer was not asked what exact words he used to offer that reassurance. Audio from the surveillance recording includes a passage that sounds like, "We're just going to cut one of those balls off." The subsequent 30 seconds of recording included the comment about dancing, the raised voices of officers saying Mr. Hyde's name, and the eruption of the struggle. And wrapping up, RCMP lawyer in Dzanski case resigns. One of the lawyers representing the RCMP in the inquiry into the death of Robert Szukanski, shot 5 times with a taser at the Vancouver airport 2 years ago, has resigned. Helen Roberts left her job in June after an email was made public that suggested RCMP officers had planned to use the taser on the 40-year-old Polish immigrant before they arrived at the scene. Mr. Szukanski died after the RCMP shot him in October 2007. In mid-June, Ms. Roberts broke down in tears as she apologized to retired Judge Thomas Braidwood, who was heading the inquiry, that she had received a copy of the email in April but had not opened it until recently. Before the email became public, the 4 officers involved in the incident had sworn under oath that they did not discuss using their tasers before they confronted a distraught Mr. Szukanski. And next week in the news, comments on the impact of the Braidwood inquiry, which is now concluded. That's it for Disrespect. Going out, Omar and the Howlers, The Boogeyman.
On in Mississippi, don't know when. Delta rocked his cradle, the blues within. Daddy played the guitar, taught him rock the blues. The boy left for Memphis to pay some dues. Something in the boy had to get out. You can't stop the boogeyman. Can't stop the boogeyman. You can't stop the boogeyman. Nothing's gonna stop the boogeyman. Up in Detroit, Hastings Street, everybody danced when they heard that beat. Boogie chillin' made history. So began his legacy. Didn't need a mouth, made his own way. You can't stop the boogeyman. You can't stop the boogeyman. Can't stop the boogeyman. Nothing's gonna stop the boogeyman. Boogeyman. Heard the news,
heard the news
the other day.
The other day,
the boogeyman,
boogeyman
passed away.
Passed away.
Changed the world,
changed the world
with his soul. Gone. You can't stop the boogeyman. Can't
You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.